This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of January 29th, here are a few top stories. In the news, Representative Don Shooter from Yuma was expelled from the legislature by a House vote this week. Let's get more on this big news story.
The Arizona Capitol is supposed to be a place to create policies for living in a civil society. But a comprehensive report found in one case those policies were bent and words disguised as humor became disturbing. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports that Republican Representative Don Shooter has now been expelled from the Arizona legislature after allegations of sexual harassment.
A packed gallery stood almost jury-like over the House chamber with its teal carpet and stately desks Thursday, an apt setting for what was to be a long, dramatic vote over whether Shooter from Yuma would lose his seat in office. Here's House Speaker J.D. Mesnard.
This is a horrifying day. I pleaded with Mr. Shooter to resign, to not force this vote. He would not back down.
The move to expel Shooter came days after the House released a lengthy report with vulgar details of his actions, words, and gestures toward women he worked with over several years. The allegations include grabbing his crotch near the face of a female lobbyist, leaving anonymous gifts for a female lawmaker, and alluding to a sexual fantasy on his bucket list. That last one was said to the then publisher of Arizona's largest newspaper. Republican Representative Kelly Townsend asked Shooter to resign and avoid an expulsion.
Today we are human beings joining together to have to do something very difficult. I don't see Republicans and I don't see Democrats and I don't see men versus women. I see statesmen.
The hours leading up to the vote were just as dramatic. One female lawmaker felt threatened by Shooter's jokes about the day being good for a hanging. Speaker Mesnard himself removed Shooter's gun from the Yuma lawmaker's office prior to convening. Before the vote, a dozen female lawmakers, all dressed in red, huddled and offered words of encouragement, prayers, and hugs to Representative Michelle Ugenti Rita, a target of Shooter's unwelcome gestures. The gavel sounded, and so began an emotional, tearful, and distraught voting session. Shooter started by voting not to remove himself. He said his merit as a politician never wavered. He kept fighting and would not resign.
I've said stupid things. I've done stupid things. I stood on the carpet. I took it like a man. I apologized. Can't go back to the past. I can't change it, but I can change the future if given the opportunity.
Then he dropped the mic on his desk before leaving the floor. Shooter did not face the lawmakers who one by one voted and then explained their reasons. Republican Representative Noel Campbell was one of three who voted against expulsion.
I am willing to censure Mr. Shooter, reprimand him, and everything that we can do. But when it comes to expulsion, you know, look at yourselves. I think it's better for the people of his district to make that decision.
And then the rest.
I vote aye.
I vote yes.
I vote yes.
I vote yes.
It's gone on for way too long. And with that, I vote yes.
That last voice was Democratic Representative Athena Salmon. Salmon was not the only lawmaker to get emotional. Many consider Shooter a friend and were upset to vote him out. Some, like Republican Becky Nutt, felt they were all setting a poor example of leadership.
You guys need to knock it off. What we're doing here is important. We have kids down here on this floor and in these desks. We're supposed to be an example to them. This is not okay.
Shooter is believed to be the first state lawmaker to be expelled from office after the Me Too movement began sweeping the nation, as women call out harassment in the workplace like that detailed in the independent report. Speaker Mesnard called for Shooter's expulsion after Shooter sent a dismissive letter about an anonymous victim in that report.
It's no small thing to override the will of the voters in LD 13. Mr. Shooter, in his time down here, has done good things for the state and his constituents and probably will only be remembered for this.
The final tally, 56-3. In about a week, the Yuma County Board of Supervisors will have three people nominated to choose from to replace Shooter. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From KJZZ's original production, here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
Is civil discussion the exception in American society today? Are we more likely to wave off or talk over someone who disagrees with us? That's been a concern for a number of years, but many believe it's gotten worse in the wake of the Trump administration. So what will get us back on track as fellow Americans and fellow community members? Princeton professors Cornel West and Robbie George frequently disagree about issues, but they call themselves and each other truth seekers. They visited ASU's Tempe campus recently for a conversation named Truth Seeking and Freedom of Expression, a Dialogue, and I met with them before that presentation. I started by asking them, Professor George answered first, why people who disagree should actually try talking things out and understanding the other person's point of view.
Because it's the best way to get at the truth of things. If two people disagree, but they're reasonable people, if there are two people who disagree but who want to know the truth and who value truth above their own opinions, then they enter into a relationship, a conversation with a view at getting the truth. The point of the kinds of conversations that Brother Cornel and I have is not victory, but truth. We're not a pair of gladiators. We've got a partnership. We're in the truth-seeking business. Mm-hmm. West and George, truth-seekers. That's what we do. And we try to get at it by examining the best arguments that we can make on the competing sides of questions.
Absolutely. We recognize that we are fallible, we are fallen, and we are finite. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we need to learn from others. We need to listen to others. And that dialogue is the very means through which any kind of democratic way of being in the world can be preserved.
I think we need to get past the idea that the goal is mere tolerance. Now, if that's the best we could do, I'd take it, because tolerance is sure better than warfare. I think it was Churchill, wasn't it, Brother Cornell, who said, jaw, jaw is better than war, war. But we shouldn't be satisfied with mere tolerance. We should try to learn from each other.
So even in the midst of this sort of conversation, the fact that two of you respect each other a lot, is the art of persuasion still there, or is this about the art of acceptance?
Oh, no, it's the art of persuasion, because we learn from each other all the time, very much so. But it's not just politics, you see, that love and friendship can't be reduced just to politics and policies, that we revel in each other's humanity, even as we may disagree about certain policies and political perspectives.
I don't want to persuade Cornell of something on which we disagree if the truth is that I'm wrong about it. I gain more if he corrects an error of mine than if I persuade him of something. Again, the point is not winning. The point is not victory. The point is truth-seeking. Each and every one of us, I just begin with me, each and every one of us knows the following. I would even dare to say, I rarely use this term, we know it infallibly. What's that thing we all know? Right now, I hold some beliefs that are untrue. So do you, so does Brother Cornell, so does everybody who's listening to this conversation. The trouble is, we don't know which ones they are. We all admit we know some of those beliefs are wrong because we're fallible. We just don't know which ones they are. With respect to each individual belief, we believe it because we believe it's true. We hold it because we believe it's true. Now, how can we shrink the set? How can we get nearer to the truth? Mm-hmm. How can we eliminate more of the false beliefs and get more of the true ones? It's by dialogue. It's by discussion. I'm not just trying to persuade the other guy, exercise in rhetoric. It's trying to learn together in a common enterprise of truth-seeking. Now, sometimes we mix it up. You know, sometimes we can go at each other. But it's with a goal of getting at the truth, not digging your heels in, not trying to win a victory, getting at the truth.
And there is a certain joy in the quest for truth. And that's not reducible to just narrow pleasure of winning. That the process itself ought to be integral to who we are. I think that's very much what trying to generate forms of civic virtue is all about, mm-hmm. but trying to sustain what John Dewey called democratic ways of being in the world.
I think part of what we so deeply share, Cornell and myself, is the idea that the truth is not merely instrumental. We want truth not just as a means to other ends, although sometimes truths are important as means to other ends, including good government. But we both have a profound sense that truth is also intrinsically valuable, that it's elevating of the human spirit, it's ennobling, it's enriching, to get nearer and nearer to the truth. So truth is something we seek, we desire, we love, not just as a means, but for its own sake, and most fundamentally, really, for its own sake. That's why we've chosen as our vocations the life of the mind.
Are we born with the ability to be open-minded, and we lose it somewhere along the way? And part of what you two are talking about is a way to get back to, regardless of whether the foundations we hold ourselves, because what you're saying makes a lot of sense. If people are actually open to other people's thoughts, how do we get people back to being open-minded? Again, is that something that is a nature versus nurture argument?
Well, I do think that children often have a sense of awe and wonder. We call it childlikeness. Children also have a deep sense of egotism and narcissism. Call that childishness. And one of the ways of learning how to grow up in a mature manner is to preserve your childlikeness and minimize your childishness.
That's good.
So that to have an open mind as an adult is really to wrestle with, you know, these egotistical and narcissistic proclivities that we all have, never fully eliminate, but we're aware that we have them and we're involved in the struggle against them. Usually children don't have an awareness or a capacity to win out over the egotistical, even though they still have that beautiful sense of awe and wonder.
So this is obviously broadened beyond a political conversation, but I do have to come back to when we think about seeking truth, and a lot of people are concerned about something that starts at the top with our president and how he views what may or may not be true. You can comment about the administration or not, but I want to know where both of you think the tone is at right now in terms of whether people are seeking as much truth now as they should be.
Well, I think there's always a challenge to try to exemplify integrity, honesty, and decency. I think Donald Trump, in so many ways, is a sign and a symptom of a certain kind of spiritual blackout, where he seems to have very little concern with integrity, honesty, and decency. Those are just basic virtues that you would hope all of us would aspire to. So in that sense, he doesn't set a good example, but the danger is to try to fetishize Donald Trump and make it look as if he has a monopoly on the spiritual blackout, as opposed to that blackout being shot through our institutions, our structures, our own hearts and minds and souls. Because when you talk about a democracy, you're really talking about citizens who fundamentally committed to integrity, honesty, and decency, concerned about others, especially the weak and the vulnerable, concerned about public life, and most importantly, concerned about something bigger than their own individual egos and their individual appetites.
Throughout the campaign, I was a rather ferocious Trump critic from the conservative side. Back in the 90s, when I joined many, many other people on the conservative side in saying, in response to what we learned about Bill Clinton's conduct and obstruction of justice and perjury, I join many people in saying character matters for leadership. Character is important. Virtue in a leader really matters, including personal virtue, integrity, honesty, uprightness, self-control, self-restraint, decent kind of humility. Those things really matter. I believed it, and I still believe it. And I'm disappointed when I see my fellow conservatives so often not acting like they believe it anymore. They said it in Clinton's case. Good for them. Now, why are they less willing to say it today? If the leader is not a truth teller, then the message that goes out to people is we do not need truth in our public discourse. We do not need truth in our politics.
Professors West and George, thanks so much.
Thank you so very much. Yes,
Cornel West and Robbie George are professors at Princeton. West is the author of Race Matters. George is the editor of A Second Look at First Things, A Case for Conservative Politics.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Let's turn now to the science desk. Thousands of Arizona mines have boomed and busted in the state's history. Now, decades after the heyday, the federal government and scientists are working to keep humans out of the abandoned mine sites while still inviting bats in. KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports.
Arizona Game and Fish Research Ecologist Joel Diamond and I roll over a dirt road near Buckeye. The area is popular with recreational shooters and four-wheelers. We're here to talk bats.
What's your favorite bat fact?
There's a species called pallid bats. They're very cute, big long ears. They have a little pig nose.
They're cute, but fierce. Diamond says pallid bats can stalk and kill scorpions. He studies these in Arizona's 27 other bat species. We're headed to a mine site that appears without warning, and it's a 90-foot drop to the bottom.
The shaft's deep enough that it's a one-way trip. If you fall in the shaft, you're probably not going to make it back out.
Game and Fish worked with federal partners to block off the mine last year.
Before we gated it, it's something you could drive your ATV right into and not notice because it was level with the ground.
The grid-like gates are specially made to let in local bats.
In the absence of these abandoned mine habitats, these bat populations would crash.
Bats need a variety of habitats to live out their lives. Unlike spacious caves, which might work as a day roost and a nursery, mines usually only serve a single purpose for bats. This mine shaft is a late-night snacking spot for California leaf-nosed bats.
They fly in there, hang off the wall, pluck the wings off whatever they're eating that day, and then have their dinner.
Arizona Game and Fish, along with the Bureau of Land Management and non-governmental organizations, have protected hundreds of mine sites across the state. Misty Shafikula manages Arizona's abandoned mine program for the BLM.
We usually prioritize on if it seems like there's a lot of public access where people could get hurt, and that's where we're going to put our money first.
There's estimated to be more than 100,000 abandoned mines in Arizona.
So a lot of these things can be picked up with satellite imagery, but you're not going to see all of them that way. And so you really do have to get out on the ground to find a lot of them.
On this day, on the ground means traversing.
Ooh, okay.
And sometimes tripping up the hills outside Parker, where another mine site is being evaluated for closure. BLM geologist Vince Beresford points out a stripe of turquoise-colored mineral on the rocks near a hole in the ground.
When they started out prospecting, they probably noticed a vein of some sort of chrysocolla at the surface and then wanted to follow that into the ground.
The chrysocolla vein marked a copper deposit. The miners' pursuit of the metal left the hillside pitted with openings. Contractor Tom Gilliland measures each one for a custom fit gate.
Most of this is built on site.
His business, Mine Gates Environmental, relies almost solely on federal contracts. He says funding for these types of projects has dried up under the current federal administration.
So like I literally just did my taxes and our revenues were half of what they were last year.
The walkthrough that brought us all to Parker was almost canceled because of the government shutdown. Nonprofits like Bat Conservation International work quickly to facilitate projects when money's available. That's who organized today's expedition.
You want to just do a quick jaunt through here and we'll point out this stuff.
Jason Corbett leads us into a rocky crevice where the ceiling's just a few feet overhead. He looks up.
Nobody home, but like it's a little pile of guano. So bats are, you know, using the site.
The guano pile, he points out, is on an old end table. The cramped space is full of trash, a sign that people are also drawn to the area. A nearby gate has clearly been used as target practice.
Seems like when a gate goes up, folks get pretty convinced that the federal gold reserves are behind that, and people love attacking them.
But the gates are built to last. Corbett says the Bat Conservation Group has worked to help gate almost 400 Arizona mines in the last decade. There are hundreds, if not thousands, left to address. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Parker, Arizona.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, Valis Martinez has lost count of how many foster children she's cared for on the Navajo Nation. She says it could be as many as 10,000. And the Navajo Department of Family Services wishes there were more like her, because the demand for safe foster homes is so high. The tribe places about 2,400 kids a year with relatives or foster parents. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
It's 2 a.m. in Tuba City, and a police officer rings Valis Martinez's doorbell. Martinez isn't alarmed. It happens all the time. She opens the door and welcomes the child. No bag, no toothbrush, just the clothes on his back and a sad story. Mom or dad were driving drunk. Parents were cooking meth or hurting each other or homeless. Martinez has heard it all.
They're scared. Some are in tears, screaming, no, take me home. But I open my arms and hug them and I said, I'm here, there's a roof here, place a warm place to sleep. Let mom settle down, dad settle down.
Martinez has had as many as 16 children at one time in her tiny home. She's also raised three of her own. When the children arrive, she says they don't want to talk. But she shares with them her own story of abuse, and they usually open up.
I had a foster child that came back and sat down. Auntie, all the clothes you bought me, my mom burned it. She said, you didn't need to be perfect. She came back with rags. And I said, no. I said, when you're going home, you put those back on. I said, we'll get you new clothes.
How do all these stories not break your heart?
They do. But it's where you have to make yourself strong, not to wipe your tears in front of them.
And for the last few years, Martinez has had help from Ronald Joe, her boyfriend. Joe says when they first went out to a Navajo song and dance with the foster kids, he was caught up with what everyone else thought of him with all these kids.
And I was just shaking. And I was sweating too, even though it was cool inside. And we sat down and I told her, people are staring at us. Then she told me, don't mind them.
Joe and Martinez say it's tricky going out in public because you don't want to run into the biological parents. And sometimes the kids start calling Martinez and Joe mom and dad. Joe's learned the hard way not to get attached, though. He helped Martinez with an infant, taught him to sit up, crawl, and just when he had learned to walk, the caseworker took him back to his family.
Man, I went down the drain. It was very hard. It was sometimes I dream of him, and, you know, do you have to treat them like your own, but try not to get really attached.
Foster home licensing specialist Elsie Elthy calls Vallis Martinez a superhero. Elthy only has two emergency homes she can turn to on the western side of the reservation. The other homes are in Flagstaff and Phoenix.
There's so many kids, and the system cannot keep up. It used to be just alcohol, and then about 15 years ago, I started hearing about meth, and that has completely destroyed families.
The 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act requires Elthy to place children first with family members. If she can't find one, then she takes them to Martinez or another Navajo foster family. If they're at capacity, then she goes to the non-Navajo families off the reservation. Children on the Navajo Nation are about four times more likely to be in the foster care system compared to the number of kids in Arizona. Last year, the tribe didn't receive federal funds for 3 months because of budget cuts to Health and Human Services. So foster parents had to dig in their own pockets to buy food and pay for gas.
I scraped, I borrowed, I begged. You know, I need some food for my families. They need clothing, you know, can you help pay for their electric bill? Can you help, you know, bring in some wood?
Elthy was once a foster kid herself before the time of the Indian Child Welfare Act. A white foster mom in California cared for her and told her, I couldn't love you more if you were my own daughter. She wanted that for other children who'd been abused or neglected.
You know, we used the concept of even though they're not my blood relatives, I'm going to treat them like they are my family. It means in the middle of the night, even though I haven't had anything to eat, you know, I'm going to help them as much as I can.
Martinez lives by the same belief. And when the children leave her home, she hopes they leave knowing they are loved. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
From the Business Desk. A Phoenix neighborhood that's expressed concern since light rail moved into the area hopes to shape future development. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports.
So you guys chime in.
Hunched over large detailed maps, residents and business owners focused on the area dubbed 19 North. It covers the Northwest Light Rail extension from Montebello Avenue to Dunlap Road.
Right along here.
Using orange and blue markers, they highlighted areas between 15th and 23rd Avenues for redevelopment. The people at Jeff Spellman's table were clear, no more affordable housing projects. Recently, it's been a popular location for developers who receive tax credits.
What we do want to see is more viable business redevelopment along the 19th Avenue corridor, the light rail corridor, so that we have good restaurants and shops and things like that that people will want to walk to and spend time at.
Other people want to see a skate park, more green space, and businesses improve lighting and landscaping. The Phoenix Planning Department will use their input as a policy guide for future redevelopment. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in education news.
Several years before the Me Too and I Have hashtags began a movement rallying support against sexual harassment and abuse in the workplace, another movement was already underway. KJZZ's Holiday Moore takes us to Barry Goldwater High School, where students are learning to stop and stand up to abusive behavior before it starts.
On a crisp morning at Barry Goldwater High School in North Phoenix, teens are scattered across a courtyard waiting for classes to start. Two girls are standing hand in hand, a boy sits with a girl's head on his shoulder, and almost everyone appears to have a pair of earbuds, listening to whatever is their favorite anthem of the month. As they file into Marlene Kepner's class, the health teacher thinks about the challenges they're facing through the tech age.
I think they're facing a lot more pressure than we did in the 80s just because of the technology and the social media.
On this morning, she's yielded her first three classes of the day to a guest visitor who is taking advantage of technology to measure social norms between teenagers.
Violence is entertaining.
That's Donna Bartos, the creator of Bloom 365, a program teaching teens about healthy relationships.
Not abusive behavior. Do you agree that if kids are watching domestic violence from little ones, that at some point they may see it as the way it's just supposed to be?
This one is particularly close to home for Bartos, who says violence became the norm in her childhood.
My mom up against the wall, and there was a nail sticking out of the wall, and I got her in the back of the head.
That top behavior, she says, led her to an abusive relationship as a teen.
My head slammed on a floor in college. It took 5 years of being verbally and mentally beaten by this person. I'm here because I don't want that to happen to any of you.
Two decades smarter, she's determined to teach 100 students at a time what it means to be wilting or blooming.
So everything that we do at Bloom 365 is based on a visual.
She's standing in front of the Bloom 365 logo of two flowers. One cowers next to the taller, healthier version of itself, and each has seven opposing roots. On the dying side, it's
unhealthy gender norms, which is rigid gender beliefs that lead to power and control in a relationship, to the social acceptance of abuse and violence, to insecurity, oppression.
The decrepit roots run up to a stem labeled power and control.
What we see on the surface, we can recognize that person is controlling or they want to gain power over someone else.
Further up the stem, the wilting flowers bloom shrugs, overloaded with symptoms of abuse.
From jealousy to isolation, humiliation, dominance, physical assaults, anything that can be considered verbal, emotional, or physical violence is in the center of that flower. And the reason
it was at this point in a Bloom presentation a year ago that 16-year-old Emma Essa had her own awakening.
I was in a relationship and I thought nothing was wrong with it until
he didn't want me talking to any other guys. I didn't recognize it as power and control. I thought he cared about me.
I was like, wait, this is happening, the wilting, the stem, and then power control, and it's wilting down.
While Bartos uses technology to track what teens think in real time,
put them in the bucket on your way out.
She uses classic note cards to track what they fear.
We hand out these elephant in the room cards, and we ask the students to think about questions they have, maybe they're uncomfortable asking in the class.
And then there's usually one card that proves Bartos' work here is still not finished.
There was one that was left today that says, "That girl standing by the door is hot, and I want to f*** her." They're trying to be funny, but what they feel is humor underlies the acceptance of looking at a girl and thinking of her as an object.
Bartos reminds them the power to control their own future is in their own hands.
When 10% of you in this room start being more kind to each other, start believing that equality is something we all deserve and need, the 90% take note. And then ultimately, violence is no longer entertaining, sexual assault is no longer funny, and men, you don't have to be aggressive, you can be who you are. All we need is 10%, and then change happens.
Holiday Moore, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa County Community College District, and Rio Salado College is partnering with Bloom 365. This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.